I am so glad you're here. This is Avery After Dark, and I'm your host, Avery Ross. This episode, I have three true hauntings for you. First up, a presence inside a home that refused to leave. After that, a ghostly figure seen again and again on a lonely Chicago road. And then, an unassuming farmhouse becomes the scene of one of the strangest paranormal events in history. Authorities were at the house and saw it happen. They later said it was one of the most unexplainable things they had ever encountered. Out of all the hauntings I've covered, these are some of the ones that still get to me. If you love mysteries, Avery After Dark is the place for you. Every week, I dive into real cases, eerie hauntings, and the strangest mysteries you will ever hear. So take your coat off, stay a while, and in the comments, let me know where you are tuning in from in the world. Let's get right into it. Our first haunting. This is the Tatum House. The story begins in a quiet suburb near Atlanta, Georgia. Jim and Kay Tatum had just built a new home with plans to retire soon. They had saved up their whole lives to build this dream home, a place they could call their own and really enjoy their upcoming years of retirement. But in January 1986, 5 months after they moved in, the Tatums began to experience a series of unsettling events, and these events would ultimately force them out of the home. The couple ended up putting their house up for sale because of what transpired inside. It all started one night when Kay and Jim Tatum had gone to bed for the evening, but Kay couldn't fall asleep. She was tossing and turning and couldn't shake this strange feeling. She sensed a presence in the hall outside their bedroom. Call it women's intuition. Her husband, Jim, was next to her fast asleep, so she quietly pushed herself out of bed and went to investigate. She walked out into their hallway, looked around, but didn't see or hear anything. So she made her way into the hall bathroom, and as soon as she did, Kay looked up and caught a glimpse of a man walking by, moving quickly down the hallway. Kay said it was definitely a man, and he was swinging his arms lightly. His head was slightly bent, and he walked quickly past me. Keep in mind, it's in the middle of the night, and it's dark. At first glance, Kay thought it was her husband, Jim. She didn't hear him get up, but figured he must have woken up. She called out, "Jim?" No response. Kay quickly walked back into their bedroom and was shocked to see there was her husband, still asleep in bed.
Uh-oh.
So Kay now thinks there is a burglar inside their home. She yelled, woke Jim up, telling him that she just saw a man walking down the hallway. She's frantic at this point, and Jim jumps up, grabs a gun, and starts looking around. He searches all over the house, checking bedroom after bedroom. He looked in every closet, every place someone could be hiding, expecting to find a burglar in the home. But the house was empty. He checked all the doors, the windows, but said there was no evidence of any entry or of anyone having been inside the home. Everything was locked up tight. This just made no sense. So Jim goes back to Kay and tells her there's no one inside the house. And Jim initially thought that his wife maybe had an overactive imagination. Maybe since it was the middle of the night, she was still half asleep. But he never knew his wife to make up this kind of thing. She was a very logical person. But there was no proof there was ever any man inside the house. But Kay knew what she saw and felt. That night, she laid in bed, unable to sleep, still creeped out. And the more she thought about it, she began to suspect that the man may have not been an actual living person at all. This is because she recalled that she didn't hear any sound as the figure passed by her. No footsteps, no movement. What you would expect if a burglar was trying to slip past in a robbery, you would hear him running down the hall. Overall, Kay was pretty bothered by the entire ordeal and remained confused and unsure as to what she even saw. Either way, the couple tried to move on, and over time, Jim made a joke out of it, occasionally teasing Kay as to what she thought she saw.
Ooh, our house is haunted.
2 months passed by without incident. Then, one evening around dinner time in March, Jim was working upstairs in the home. He was doing a little fixing up and had all of his tools out. He stopped for the evening when Kay called him down to dinner, and as he always did, he made sure to unplug his drill before he left it. It was an older drill and would get really hot if it was left plugged in. So, As a safety measure, he always made sure to unplug it from the wall socket. Jim then left and went downstairs. After dinner, Jim decided to watch a movie while Kay went back upstairs to read. An hour or so later, Kay was lying in bed and then heard the sound of Jim's drill turning on and revving up, coming from outside her room in the hallway. She heard it, clear as day. Kay assumed that Jim was teasing her again about having seen the ghost and was turning on the drill to try and mess with her. But the drill kept revving and revving. Eventually, Kay felt the joke had gone on long enough. Very funny, but it was getting annoying now. So she got up, walked out, and once she stepped into the hallway, the drill sound immediately stopped. She looked down the hallway and saw that the drill was unplugged, and Jim was nowhere to be found. She called out to him and realized he was still downstairs watching a movie. So now this is the second incident, and Kay is starting to become really frightened. She said she was even more spooked when she reached down to feel the drill, and it was ice cold. It had not been turned on. Kay immediately went downstairs and tells Jim about what happened. And at this point, Jim too started to believe that something strange was going on. He said he knew that something was happening because Kay, his wife, who he had been married to for decades, was a very level-headed person. For her to be this scared, something was going on inside the house. And the couple wasn't quite sure why Kay was the only one experiencing these things. In covering their bases, the Tatums were very rational. They had their home tested for a carbon monoxide leak. Maybe that was the issue leading to Kay seeing and hearing these things. But there was no leak of any kind. The house was in perfect order. She was checked by a doctor, completely healthy. Unfortunately for the Tatums, there was no logical explanation for what was going on. And the strange events continued. One night, Kay heard the sound of coins falling into a bowl from the other room, and she was at home alone. Another time, while cooking, as Kay stood facing the counter preparing lunch, she felt two sharp tugs on the back of her blouse, as if someone was standing behind her, yanking on her shirt. She whipped around, there was no one there. So now, the entity was getting more physical. She said, "After that incident, I decided we had a problem in this house. It wasn't something that we could understand or explain, but there was something definitely going on." Uneasy about what was happening inside their house, Jim and Kay turned to an expert and enlisted the help of a parapsychologist named William Roll. Parapsychology refers to the study of paranormal activity, psychic phenomenon, and many other paranormal claims such as near-death experiences. They are studiers of the supernatural. But as you may expect, this area of work and study isn't widely accepted or embraced by the scientific world. So William Roll came over to the house, met the Tatums, and interviewed them. He also toured the home and tried to get a sense of what was going on. William Roll was interviewed and said, "The question comes up, why is this family having these experiences? Is there some sort of ghost that has come back to haunt them for some unknown reason? What's taking place? A lot of people have these experiences. It's part of who we are as humans, to have these so-called psychic experiences. But who or what the spirit was that seemed to emerge out of the blue and attach itself to the home and to Kay remained a mystery. And it wasn't long before Jim finally had his first experience with the entity. It started with a small bell. Now, Jim was usually an early riser and would get up hours before Kay. In the mornings, he would go downstairs, have breakfast, read the paper. And when Kay woke up, she would ring the bell if she needed anything upstairs, if she needed help with anything. One morning, Jim heard what he assumed was Kay ringing the bell from upstairs. He made the usual climb to the top floor, but when he got to their bedroom, he found his wife still fast asleep. He thought it was strange, but brushed it off. But it happened again a few more times. He would be downstairs, hear the bell ring, only to go upstairs and find his wife still asleep. Who was ringing the bell? After the third time this happened, the Tatums began discussing how they could handle this. And they decided to make up a code in order to outwit the entity. Yeah. So out loud in the kitchen, they discussed this. And Kay said that if it was actually her, she would ring the bell 3 times if she wanted Jim to come upstairs. They came to an agreement and thought that this should solve the issue. Can you guess what happened next? Shortly after this, one morning, Jim heard the bell, and he said it rang 3 times. Thinking this had to be his wife, he went upstairs to find that Kay was still sound asleep, and the bell had been moved to another bedroom. Jim said he went in, looked at the bell, then turned around and was walking out the door. And as he was, the bell rang again, on its own. So not only did this entity obviously know about the deal they made, it appeared it was enjoying messing with them. At this point, Jim was absolutely freaked out. When interviewed, he said he began to see how Kay had been feeling, being so scared. Having these really creepy experiences, he said the hair on the back of his neck stood up, and he told Kay from then on, no more bell. He was not going to answer that bell anymore. And after he said that out loud to his wife, the bell never rang ever again. In the interviews with Jim, when he speaks about the haunting, he actually gets pretty emotional. I think for 2 reasons. One, he finally realized what his wife had been going through and was feeling sympathy for her. Maybe he felt bad for dismissing it in the beginning and making a joke out of it. Secondly, this entire thing seemed to really change his view on the supernatural. He said that he had never, ever experienced anything like this and wasn't a believer in the paranormal until this happened. Because not only did he hear the bell ringing on its own countless times, it was clear that whoever this ghost was, this entity, wanted to mess with the couple. Overall, a good lesson can be learned here. You can't trick a ghost. They can walk through walls. They see everything. William Roll spoke of the case and said, "There are a number of haunting cases that are not very striking, not very strong, but where the phenomenon is, nevertheless, is quite disturbing to the family. It might be a bell ringing, a fleeting glimpse of an apparition. The events are trivial, but they're deeply upsetting to the family because they don't fit into the picture that most of us have of the world." Very well put. In the end, although their experiences weren't the kind that would send you running out the front door in the middle of the night, the Tatums ultimately decided that they wanted no part of it. They put the house up for sale shortly after the incident with the bell ringing and sold it to another family. They said it wasn't so much that they felt the ghost was dangerous. Kay always said it seemed more like a teasing prankster spirit, but they just weren't up for living in a haunted house. And a lot of people aren't. They were really looking for a relaxed retirement, not spending their days cohabitating with a ghost who enjoyed pulling pranks on them. And after moving into another home, they never reported any experiences like this ever again. So whatever it was, didn't seem to follow them. And upon looking a bit more into the area this all took place, it said this was the corner from the bloody battle of the Kennesaw Mountain near Marietta, Georgia. The battle was fought in June 1864 and was the most significant frontal assault landed by Union General William Sherman against the Confederate Army of Tennessee. We all know the South, Georgia, holds a lot of Civil War history. And the story is that this new housing development was placed on the land of the battle site. And according to friends and family of the Tatums, they reportedly believed that the ghost in their home was likely an old Civil War soldier. Given the history of the land and the fact that Kay saw a male entity, this seems like a likely explanation. For whatever reason, the spirit seemed to gravitate towards the Tatums and stuck around. The story of the Tatums' haunting is an interesting one because it wasn't anything outlandishly scary. I mean, if I saw a man walking past me in my hallway in the middle of the night, I would be freaking out just like Kay was. But this haunting was a bit more subdued. There was obviously something going on inside the Tatums' home. And the ties to the Civil War battleground add an extra layer of spookiness to the story. A good question is, what would be scarier? A haunting with a spirit that's more evident and in your face, or an entity that is more discreet and plays tricks on you and messes with your family over a long period of time, psychologically wearing you down? Personally, I would prefer neither, and just have a Casper the Friendly Ghost hanging around? I would like that. Very much. Next up, a haunting in Chicago. The legend of the ghostly hitchhiker. The story has been passed down through generations. It typically involves a solitary traveler encountering a mysterious female hitchhiker on a dark, desolate road. This traveler offers the woman a lift, only for her to vanish without a trace at some point during the ride. Many versions of this scary story include the driver ultimately reaching the woman's requested destination to find she has been dead for years. This hitchhiker, a ghost, the spirit of someone who died tragically along that stretch of road, doomed to repeat their journey in search of closure or revenge. I always thought, wow, this is a great ghost story. Until recently I learned, this legend is based on a real-life haunting. One of the most haunted cemeteries in the United States is Chicago's Resurrection Cemetery, and it's home to one especially active ghost. Her name? Resurrection Mary, also known as the Ghost of Archer Avenue. She's had countless encounters with dozens of witnesses throughout the years. This haunting is regarded as one of the most compelling cases because of how many people have encountered Mary's ghost firsthand. Something about being out on the road in the dark, you never know who or what you'll pass along the way. In Justice, Illinois, sits Resurrection Cemetery on Archer Avenue, just a few miles southwest of Chicago, the final resting place for more than 150,000 souls. The cemetery spans almost 400 acres, and it's home to one ghost in particular, considered to be Chicago's most famous spirit, Resurrection Mary. Since the 1930s, numerous men and women driving northeast along Archer Avenue between the Willowbrook Ballroom and Resurrection Cemetery have reported seeing and picking up a young female hitchhiker. She's always described as wearing a long white gown, a party dress. She has blonde hair and blue eyes. She's most frequently seen walking very slowly along the side of the road, and those who have spoken with her say she's very quiet. When picked up, she will request to be taken to the cemetery, where she will disappear into it. According to the Chicago Tribune, a paranormal investigator named Richard Crow has collected 36 substantiated reports of Mary from the 1930s to today. Richard said all these witnesses were very level-headed, normal folks, and they all share similar encounters with ghostly Mary. It all really began in 1939 with a man named Jerry Palis. Jerry, in his 20s at the time, lived in the south side of Chicago, and one night, he went with some friends to the Liberty Grove Dance Hall at 47th and Mozart. In this time period, dance halls were the place where young folks would go, socialize, have fun, and dance. There, he spotted a woman across the room that caught his attention instantly. Jerry described this woman as pretty, about 5'7", wearing a long white dressy gown, shoulder-length blonde hair. Jerry could not take his eyes off of this woman. He asked some friends, "Hey, do you all know who that girl is?" His friends saw her and said they didn't know, so he decided to go ask her to dance. Jerry said this woman agreed, and the two began to dance the night away. She told him her name was Mary. Jerry said he found her captivating, but noted she was quiet and also very cold to the touch. He even mentioned to her hands were cold as ice. The only information Jerry got out of Mary was that she lived in the South Side, just like him, in a house on South Damon. Jerry was familiar with that area and really recognized the house that she was referring to. As the night came to a close, Jerry offered to give Mary a ride back home, assuming she would want to be dropped off at her house, and Mary did accept a ride. But strangely, she didn't ask him to take her home. Instead, she requested to be driven down Archer Road. He didn't really know why she would want to travel down that way so late at night. He asked her, "Why do you want to go that way? You just told me where you live. That's in the other direction." And he said that Mary was adamant, requesting that they take a drive down Archer Road. So he agreed. They got in the car, started driving, and Jerry continued to question why she wanted to come in this direction, commenting on how dark it was out that way. He said that Mary remained quiet. Then, as they approached Resurrection Cemetery, Mary requested that Jerry stop the car. He does exactly what she asks and pulls over in front of the front gates, but continues to question, "What are we doing here?" He said Mary told him to wait at the car, and then she began walking towards the cemetery gates. And then, according to Jerry, Mary vanished before his very eyes. She was there 1 second and gone the next. He was stunned and didn't know what to make of this. So the next day, he got in his car and drove over to Damon Avenue, specifically to the home where Mary said that she lived. There, he walked up to the front door of a small brick house, and before he could knock, a woman opened the door. He began asking about Mary, informing this woman that she had told him that she lived at this house. The woman at the door looked distressed and basically said, "You must be mistaken." He said, "No, I'm not. I danced with a Mary all last night. We met at the dance hall and really hit it off." The woman quickly interrupted him and said, "That's impossible for him to have met Mary, as she was her daughter, but she had been dead for years." Jerry was in shock, but with Mary disappearing into the cemetery, along with her hands being so cold to the touch, it all began to click for Jerry. He had met a ghost and danced with her all night long. He had given a ride to a spirit. Jerry was interviewed later in his life about this incident, saying that he later worked in a funeral home and found that the corpses he came into contact with there had the exact same feeling as holding Mary's hand. Jerry left the home that day without getting any more information on Mary or the family, and throughout the years was perplexed by the entire experience. Jerry has since passed away, but said this absolutely happened, and he never forgot it. And this kicked off a series of Mary sightings and encounters. Over the years, many researchers have attempted to identify Mary, and many believe this ghost was a woman named Mary Bregovi. Mary was killed in a traffic accident one Saturday night in 1934, a month before her 21st birthday. Many locals theorize that Mary had spent her final hours at the dance hall, and the encounters continued throughout the years. In January 1979, it was a cold Chicago evening, and a cab driver was making his way down Archer and became lost. It was getting late, and he looked up to see a young woman walking alone alongside the road. He pulled up next to her and asked her for directions. He said she remained quiet. He asked again, even offering to give her a ride for free in exchange for her help. He described the woman as blonde, blue-eyed, wearing a long white gown. And she finally agreed, hopping into the back of his cab. The two continued down the road. Over a mile ahead was Resurrection Cemetery. The two weren't in the car for long when the woman in white told the cab driver to stop in front of the cemetery. He did so, and when he turned around to ask her why she wanted to stop here, he said she had disappeared from the car without even a door slam. He had just encountered Resurrection Mary, and many other male cab drivers have reported similar experiences over the years. Most times, Mary's ghost is seen wandering down the road that Resurrection Cemetery sits on, like she's on a loop, but it gets spookier. In 1973, Mary was reportedly seen at another nightclub, a place called Harlow's on Cicero Avenue in Chicago's southwest side. That same year, a cab driver came into Chet's Melody Lounge, a spot across from Resurrection Cemetery. He was asking around about a young lady in a white gown with blonde hair who had vanished without paying her cab fare. Many believe this was Resurrection Mary, looking for someone to take her home after a night on the town. Another woman local to Chicago named Claire Rudnicki had heard mentions of Resurrection Mary for years, ghost stories, but didn't really give it much thought as she had never seen a ghost and didn't really believe in them. Until late one night in 1980, she, along with her husband Mark and another friend, were driving out along Archer Road. It was dark when suddenly they spotted a lone woman walking alongside the road on the right side. Claire said this woman was glowing white, bright, illuminating. She said she was walking very slow, and Claire immediately said her stomach dropped, realizing that this was Resurrection Mary, and she immediately got scared. Mark insisted that they turn back around and try to talk to her, but Claire said no, she was so frightened. The group said that as they passed her, they tried to get a look at her face, but said it seemed like there was just a black void. Mark was thoroughly convinced that they had seen a ghost, as he too had witnessed her, how bright she was, and said there was no way anyone could have pulled a prank like that. This was very real, and by the time the car eventually turned around, the group saw that she had vanished. Another woman had a terrifying encounter with Resurrection Mary in October 1989. A woman named Janet Kalal was out driving around Chicago with a friend one evening. She and her friend Pamela had been out for about an hour when they found themselves passing by the gates of Resurrection Cemetery. When all of a sudden, a woman in all white, gown and blonde hair blowing back behind her, quickly darted from the gates of the cemetery into the road. Janet and Pamela screamed, feeling they were about to slam into this woman. But as Janet laid on the brakes, bracing for impact, they were shocked. There was no impact. They didn't hit anyone or anything. They both got out of the car, looked around, but didn't see a soul. Janet said, quote, "This young woman ran out in front of my car and I hit her," end quote. She was certain of it. Janet's friend Pamela witnessed the exact same thing. She too saw the woman jump in front of the car. And this was not the only case of Resurrection Mary seemingly jumping in front of people's cars. Outside the cemetery, there were other confirmed sightings in 1976, 78, 80, and 89, and they're all similar in nature. Although her haunting stories have stood the test of time, there is so much about Mary that remains a mystery. According to these witnesses, she never reveals much. The only request she has is to be taken back to the cemetery. Like I said, it's like she's on a loop on that road. Per reports, it's said that reports of sightings have dropped off since their peak in the 1970s and 1980s, which is also very mysterious. Where did Mary go? Is she still roaming the cemetery? And if so, why has she stopped engaging with the living world? This is by far one of the most compelling and interesting hauntings because of how interactive Mary's spirit was. Hopefully, Mary went into the light and found peace. Our next story, the haunting of the Odin Farmhouse. One house, one day, 28 fires. Was this the work of a poltergeist? One morning, a 1940s Indiana farmhouse once had 28 fires set in one day by an unseen force, and it was never explained. Many, including the Hackler family, who called this historic farmhouse home for years, believed this was the work of an angry poltergeist. Odin, Indiana is a peaceful small town and not one you would suspect of having a history of paranormal mysteries. Yet on April 19, 1941, the Hackler family farmhouse would be the setting of one of the strangest supernatural puzzles of modern times. 28 separate fires broke out all over the family's farmhouse, out of nowhere, and all of these fires were as random as it gets. Some of the items that were set ablaze were random walls, curtains, books, a calendar, a mattress, and a wooden bowl in a cupboard. All burst into flames without rhyme or reason. One firefighter called it the most bizarre mystery he had ever come across in his career. At the center of this story is the farmhouse, and it was owned by the Hackler family. This family consisted of William and his wife Minnie, and their children, William Jr., Dorothy, Garland, Dale, and Virginia. The Hacklers had lived in the same house for over 10 years. It was home for them. The place was built just after the Civil War, and the area had a lot of history. On the morning of April 19th, it was a beautiful spring morning with clear blue skies. William made his way outside to begin work for the day, as he always did, when suddenly he began to smell smoke.
He turned around and saw what appeared to be flames coming from below the second floor window of the farmhouse. William ran back inside to alert his wife, and he and his children ran upstairs to find there was a fire beneath the window coming from the wall. Firefighters were called and got to the scene, and they quickly put out the fire. But strangely, there was no damage or scorch marks to the surrounding walls. Now, thinking that the fire came from inside the wall, as it appeared, it was odd they couldn't find where it actually started, or a reason for it. They couldn't locate any damage to any of the surrounding areas, for that matter. Firefighters hadn't really seen anything like this before. So they speak with William and Minnie. They're all puzzled and admit that this was strange, but the fire was put out. There was no immediate danger. Or so they thought. The firefighters left shortly after, but reportedly, the second they got back to the station, they received another call from Minnie and she was scared. She said they needed to come back immediately as there was now a second fire inside the house, this time coming from a mattress. The firefighters rushed back to the farmhouse, located the second fire, and put this one out. And after this, things got really strange. As the firefighters were still inside the home, another fire began right in front of a firefighter and William. William's clothing, hanging on the back of a door, went up in flames. As they rushed to put this out, two more fires started up out of nowhere. One fire on the complete opposite side of the farmhouse, and another inside of a book. But not the book itself, inside the pages. A firefighter said that he looked over to suddenly see smoke was pouring out of the pages of a book. When he opened it up, a small fire was quickly burning each page. Next, a lampshade burst into flames. Then a rug. Next, one part of one chair. Then, a wooden bowl that was inside a cupboard. Nothing else inside the cupboard was on fire, and there was little to no damage to anything around the bowl. Within 3 hours, 9 more fires from all corners of the house had broken out. This was unbelievable, and things were out of control. As the hours ticked by and small fires continued to erupt all over, it seemed there was no sign of this stopping, and no one knew where this was coming from. Eventually, the Odin Fire Department became overwhelmed, and they requested assistance from another fire brigade. They were just in over their heads. Over 100 firefighters were at the farmhouse. Many of these men were standing outside, directing those inside where to go next as they watched fire after fire start. One firefighter at the scene was inside the family's kitchen, looking for anything that could be causing this, looking for any sign of smoke. That's when he looked up and saw a calendar the family had hanging on the wall was smoking, and then flames began shooting from it. What? The firefighter was stunned and said it almost seemed like it was magic or something. Neighbors of the Hackler family saw what was going on and arrived to help, as the firefighters continued their work inside, putting out fires. And the family began dragging out all of their furniture from the house. This included chairs, mattresses, anything they could save from the fires. They were essentially watching their entire home and all their belongings be destroyed at random, and this went on all day long. None of the children wanted to even step foot inside the house. The family was in complete and utter shock and horror. One witness said, "It was like unseen hands were lighting matches all over the house." One of the last things that the firefighters had to put out was a set of curtains by the window near the front door. In front of several noted witnesses, these curtains went up in flames just behind where two people were standing. And as soon as these were put out, curtains from the opposite end of the house caught fire. Both times, the fire seemed to destroy only the curtains, leaving everything else undamaged. Upstairs at this very moment, another fire started in a bedroom beneath the only mattress that was left in the house. This was particularly strange as this fire was intense and within just a few minutes, nothing was left of the mattress but ashes. After this fire was put out, the family and firefighters waited for another to start, but finally it appeared the nightmare was over. The final fire was put out about an hour before midnight. More than 13 hours after this bizarre nightmare began. In total, more than 100 firefighters from two towns and numerous nearby neighbors found and put out 28 fires at the Hackler's house. No one was injured, and there was no real damage to the house itself. But how? How could this be? After this, all anyone had were questions. The Hackler family was sick at the fact that no one had any explanation for what had happened. Fire investigators were thoroughly baffled. The fires were not electrical in origin. The farmhouse, much like many of the out-in-the-sticks Indiana farmhouses in the early 1900s, was not outfitted with any electrical wiring. So that wasn't it. There were no power lines nearby, no lightning strikes, or any other atmospheric phenomenon or bad weather that could possibly explain all the fires. That evening, the Hacklers moved their remaining beds outside and slept outdoors that night. They were afraid of another fire breaking out in the house while they were asleep. It just wasn't worth the risk, and they were at a loss of what had just happened to their home. As you can imagine, this became the talk of the town. Neighbors and town locals began to say that the farmhouse was cursed. It had to be haunted. Some pointed to the family and said it was their fault. They were the ones who started all the fires. And the Hacklers couldn't really even defend themselves, as they had no explanation for what had happened. In a later interview, the Indiana State Fire Marshal stated that the Odin fires were by far the most baffling mystery of his entire career. And in the end, the case was closed with no answers. And to this day, the puzzling events of that day are completely unexplained. It's even more mind-bending when you realize the Hacklers had lived in this house for more than a decade without any activity like this. Theories began to pop up. Some said the farmhouse must sit on a powerful magnetic field, and due to its energy and location, this led to the sporadic fires. Others blame gases, which some thought had made their way into the farmhouse, and this is what caused the fires. Spontaneous combustion was another popular theory. But for that to occur 28 times in one home in one day was unbelievable. But the most popular theory around town was that this was paranormal. These fires were caused by a vengeful spirit, a poltergeist. Many believed the house was just cursed. And the Hackler family didn't know what to make of what happened, but they did know this. Whatever caused it was evil. They felt this was an attack. After, the Hackler family and a fire marshal began investigating the history of the farmhouse. They found that prior to the Hacklers' ownership of the farmhouse, tragedy had struck there twice. A man by the name of Marshall Ketchum built the farmhouse and lived there with his wife and their children for about 15 years, until the unthinkable happened. One by one, each of the Ketchum's five children passed away from typhus. Marshall died a few years later, and many thought it was due to a broken heart. His wife passed away shortly after that. But here's the strange thing. A nickname for typhus is the burning fever. The next family that moved into the farmhouse was the Wilkie family. Andrew Wilkie, his wife, and their two sons lived in the house. But during a hunting trip, one of the sons was accidentally shot and killed. After this, it was said that Andrew, grief-stricken, also died of a broken heart. And both men are said to be buried on the property. So given this, many felt that the farmhouse and the land itself was cursed for any and all families who moved in. Following the 28 fires, the Hackler family wasn't going to take any chances. They decided to tear down the farmhouse and rebuild a new house somewhere else. Literally. Bit by bit, the men of the Hackler family disassembled the entire farmhouse, only to rebuild it in a location not too far from the original one. And they said they never experienced anything again. But the legend of the 28 fires lived on for decades. What do you believe happened inside that farmhouse that day? Do you think there's a logical explanation that just hasn't been found yet? Or do you believe that this was paranormal? Like many in the town believed, was this the work of a vengeful spirit, aiming to get retaliation on the family or anyone who took up residence in the house? A place that had seen so much tragedy in decades before? Was that farmhouse, the land, really cursed? Given how strange and unexplainable this case is, I'm leaning towards the latter. But what about you? What are your theories? Leave them in the comments. I cannot wait to hear. I would love it if you subscribe to this channel, and if you haven't already, leave a like and a comment. And let me know what cases, places, and stories you'd like to see next on Avery After Dark. Next week, I have another very mysterious and chilling episode coming your way. Until then, I'm Avery Ross, and this is Avery After Dark.